The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Hello, welcome everybody. I direct the Interdisciplinary Humanities Centre, which is this facility is part of our real estate. The Interdisciplinary Humanities Centre is one of the co-sponsors of this afternoon's event, along with the American Cultures and Global Context Centre and the Centre for Film, TV and New Media. The event, as you know, if you've read the flyers, and I'm sure you all have, is divided into parts. First, a reading or talking through some of the issues in Celine Shimizu's new book. Celine is prolifically hyper-productive colleague in UCSB's Asian American Studies Department, as most of you will know, and she'll be talking about her new book entitled, again, the hyper word, The Hypersexuality of Race, Performing Asian American Women on Screen and Scene, published in August by Duke University. And after the event, please go and possess a copy of this book. To follow up. The book examines the production of sexuality for Asian women in Western moving image culture in early cinema, stag films, etc. I'm going to let Celine talk about the book because she read it and wrote it and knows more intimately the content. The reading will be followed by a panel discussion with her own professor Constance Penley from Film and Media and Mireille Miller-Young from Women's Studies, again, two figures are probably familiar to everybody here. The panel, as those of you who have read the flyer will know, has been wryly dubbed the Porn Panel to underline the remarkable fact that the UCSB boasts three of the nation's strongest cultural critics working today on pornography and film media studies. I have to say, as a kind of personal footnote here, that as a long-time student of the porn scene, and as a fledgling scholar in the burgeoning area of porn studies, having recently completed some research on Japanese schoolgirl and Lolita complex erotica, and the monumental hypersexual fiberglass figurines of contemporary Japanese business artist Takashi Murakami, I'm definitely a junior colleague here in these terms, but I am especially pleased and honoured that we are able to host this panel, and I feel proud to work in the same institution as Celine, Connie, and Murray, who have done such pioneering work in this area. So the format for this afternoon goes like this. First, Celine will talk about her book, then Connie and Murray and Celine will discuss the book for around 10 minutes. Then we're going to throw it open to questions. And when you ask a question, can you raise your hand, as this is being filmed for UCTV, and someone will come up with a microphone and we can get the whole thing recorded. And then there will be a reception and everybody will buy a copy of Celine's book, I hope. So please join me in welcoming to the podium our colleague, Celine Shimizu.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you very much to Stephanie Lemonager, the director of the American Cultures and Global Context Center in the English Department, and Connie Penley, film studies colleague and director of the Carsey Wolf Center for Film, Television, New Media, and Dick Hebdige of the IHC, as well as Holly Unruh and all of you who are here. Thank you very much for coming to hear about the book, and especially about the pornography work in the book. The kernel for writing the book was planted exactly 20 years ago when I was entering as an undergraduate at UC Berkeley. I was 17, and I wasn't very well planned as a student, so I came to school very late, and I couldn't find an apartment, and so I was living very far away, an hour and a half bus ride every day. And so on this bus ride, the number 51, for all of you from the Bay Area, I would ride in the back, and I think just so happy to be out of my parents' house. And maybe that was why this man approached me and felt that he had to say something to me, which was, haven't I met you before? Didn't we have a relationship, you know, in Manila? And didn't I meet you when you were working in a bar, you know, throwing ping pong balls out of your vagina? And I was, of course, shocked, and I didn't know what to say, and I was really afraid, and I really just felt that because I was too happy, I had to be somehow disciplined, or maybe he was just this insane person on the bus. And at that moment, what entered my mind was, I am not that woman. I am a good woman. I am an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, you know, a clean woman. And I felt very adamant about that. I don't remember what actually happened. I don't think I even said anything. I don't think I even ran away. I think I just sat there. And I then found myself, you know, in various classes at UC Berkeley, where I really just started paying attention to this kind of sexualization of Asian women that I noticed around me. And I found myself seeing Nancy Kwan in The World of Susie Wong, a 1960 very popular movie, and I just loved watching her, you know, with her matching bags and her matching dress and her awesome dance moves and everyone looking at her in the movie as this kind of object of desire, and I had never seen that before, so I thought that was just great. And I was once again just happily consuming her until my classmates started glaring at me, telling me that that was a bad image that I wasn't supposed to enjoy. And so I thought, okay, I can't, I have to stop smiling and loving this. And so many more incidents like that, and I slowly found myself just, you know, really loving the sight of these women, you know, Anime Wong from the 1920s, so powerful in her kind of long fingernails and the way she just had was pulling all these shenanigans, you know, and trying to take over the world and somehow had her own agenda, and I thought that was just great. And so I found that I was this spectator who also had to be disciplined because I was consuming in the wrong way, that there was this proper way of consuming something and we had to condemn it. So slowly I realized that when it comes to both representation and sexuality, the most easy response to it is to panic because of its power, whether it's the power of sexuality or the power of representation to shape your ideas. I found it very easy to flee from it, to respond to it badly, to condemn it. And I found that to be terrifying when I started to see that some of these movies were ways for Asian American women themselves to file complaints about the kinds of representations and realities that they had. You know, so I started seeing these images, whether it's Anime Wong complaining in fan culture about the roles that she had to take, or Nancy Kwan saying, it's very important for me to take up the position of a normal woman, you know, because Asian American women didn't have access to being a lead in a romantic movie, for example, a Hollywood movie. So these women were somehow fighting for access to representations that better reflected their realities and somehow wanted to contribute to those representations. And those representations were somehow engaging sexuality. So they were somehow saying, yes, indeed, there's the sexuality that's being imposed upon me, or a sexuality that's being demanded upon me, but I'm going to engage it somehow, converse with it, and try to author it in my own various ways. So I find myself unalone in terms of this obsession with sexuality and representation, and I found it a very productive way to talk about these issues in our society of power, of representation, of our subjectivity, or even, you know, how do these images limit or unleash our imaginations of what kinds of roles are possible for us? So I found that those questions were more productive than panicking about, you know, how these images reaffirm what may be natural to Asian women because of the sex industry, for example. I found that those kinds of panicky questions didn't really deal with what was happening with the image, what specifically the image was trying to do. Rather, panicking about these larger issues of these images lead directly to inequalities of the sex industry was too general and too irresponsible a critique, and that we had to be much more specific about it. So the book first looks at Miss Saigon. I became very obsessed with Miss Saigon. I saw it 12 times on Broadway. I was, you know, always trying to find women in the musical to talk to. And as a Filipina-American woman, that was kind of interesting because it's Filipina-American women playing Vietnamese women in Miss Saigon, and it was somehow through my being Filipina, I was able to hook up with these other Filipinos who somehow, I started talking to all of these women in the show and asking them, well, why are you performing these crotch grabs? And it was very interesting to in a deliberate move on my part, to start talking about these images in terms of the stage, because these images, if you were to ask, where does this image of this hypersexual Asian woman come from? So you start thinking, oh, 1887, Madame Chrysanthemum, 1904, Madame Butterfly, the kind of sexy, suffering, suicidal Asian woman with unrequited love. The white American or European man doesn't love her enough, so she has to kill herself and give up her kid. You know, so this kind of crazy, abnormal, pathological love, you know. So I thought that it's interesting, in 1989, this was, you know, rehearsed again in Miss Saigon. And why? Why again? Why this suffering, sexy, suicidal Asian woman? And so I wanted to find out why, and it was so interesting that these Filipino women were doing it, and I thought, huh, these women are also authoring it, you know? And can we have room in our analysis to figure out how these women are engaging the history of this image? And I found out, you know, through my interviews that they somehow considered their every night on stage performance as struggles and battles for recognition with the audience. You know, they say, oh, the audience don't want to attribute anger to us because we're short, petite Asian women. They just can't imagine that we can be performing the role of the prostitute with anger. So I thought that was very interesting. So it enabled me to start thinking, but well, how can we study these images? It's important to talk to the women as possible agents in authoring these images as well. That representation is an encounter not only with history, but an encounter, a struggle, a power relationship between the directors and the actors, the producers, the choreographers, and somehow they're trying to comment on history and create new representations. So I found that very important to honor in the process of looking at these images. They are not fixed images, but they're very vibrant, and they're going to speak to you in different ways. So I ended up going to archives in Los Angeles and archives in Washington, D.C. to see all of Anna May Wong's films. And she had a very interesting life because she definitely exploited, you know, fan culture to comment on her performances and to say, I hated these performances, but I had to do them somehow. And, you know, her life itself was a testimony to the kind of bind that Asian women as actors had to live with. The bind of, you know, I want to be an actress and I can't be an actress if I tell myself I can't play these terrible roles. But what if I do play these terrible roles and somehow insert my critique in them? So that's what she was trying to do in fan culture. It's very interesting, all the footage that she has, you know, trying to counter the representations from the movies. And so I also noticed that, you know, Lucy Liu's own interviews compared to Anna May Wong's interviews were very different, so that we can't measure progress in a very easy way, where Anna May Wong could be very irate and very angry and make demands about the role she plays, but Lucy Liu doesn't have that same kind of struggle where I feel like she has to perform a different kind of dance with the audience. You know, there's the audiences today are very diverse and very sophisticated in terms of their demands upon the actors. Like, why is Lucy Liu always a dominatrix, right? A critique in the New York Times. So it's very sophisticated in terms of race. So Lucy Liu has to say things like, I have to perform these roles to create new opportunities so that I can author my own image. So it's very different from Anna Mae Wong saying, I hated making that movie. You know, so Lucy Liu can't say that, right? So after I started, you know, doing these more conventional, you know, methods of the archive as well as interview, I felt that pornography was one of the most important ways we were informed about the fantasies of Asian women. And so I had never seen pornography before until this project. And I found myself going to the Kinsey Institute in Bloomington, Indiana, over a period of 2 years, a total of 6 weeks, watching porn from 8 to 5 with a lunch break from 12 to 1 in a glass room, you know, where you would watch the films in a way that was visible to others. I don't think that they were monitoring me or studying me as I was watching these films. I really don't. But I thought it was very interesting that when you go to the bathroom, there's like multiple kinds of soap. You know? Very interesting. At the Kinsey Institute, I was studying the films along with, you know, other people who wanted to learn about sexuality because there were, you know, lawsuits about sexual harassment or pedophilia or something. But I was there to study the pornography as an academic, and you have to apply to the Kinsey Institute. No one can just come in. So it's very interesting in terms of the study of sexuality in this country. It's not really that easy, you know. And they are very protective about the archives as well because of the kind of history that's been attributed to them as kind of, you know, gatekeepers of perversity. So at the Kinsey Institute, it was also very painful to watch the films because they were disintegrating before my very eyes. I would watch these Super 8 films, 8mm films, 16mm films, and there was no money for preservation, so I was watching them. They were just disintegrating. So that was really horrible. But it was also hard to find what the study over thousands of titles that they had. And so I thought that I would see at least 200 stag films that would give me a measure of, you know, African-American representations, white sex, you know, the kind of classics of stag pornography being these short films around 10 minutes long, anonymously made and distributed in male-only venues, right? And so in these films, I found titles that indicated some kind of Asian difference. So like, you know, Oriental Girlfriend, China, films like that. And what I noticed in these films was they changed the convention of what was expected of the stag film. In the stag film, unlike contemporary pornography where it's all about the money shot and the proof of the pleasure, the unquestionable proof of the, you know, ejaculation in the woman's face, the money shot, it was enough to look at the stag films and see that some kind of intercourse was happening, some kind of penetration. But, and so that was the focus of the thing, was to see the genital shot. And the stag film was also an important form of education for men, you know, what to do sexually. And what I found in these films was that while there was a discourse of yellow peril, race suicide, eugenics, and a kind of fear about Asian sexuality, both about men and women, and what the face of America was going to look like when people were getting together, just the reproductive threat of interracial sex, that there was not so much a threat in the pornography, but a kind of enjoyment of the treat of racial difference, an unabashed, unashamed kind of just, there's this sexual difference going on and let's have it inform what we see on the screen. So the genital shot was no longer just proof of the penetration or proof of some kind of intercourse, touching. It became a racialized genital shot. So they would insert, for example, an oriental shoe or like a shoji screen or like the cue of the man, somehow to remind you that there was some kind of racial difference going on. And they would also do it through the intertitle text where they would say things like, you know, the Shanghai gesture, or, you know, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's in the book, something like the slanted oriental vagina, even though you can see that it's not, but they had to somehow say it to let you know that this was going on, which is very different from like the black-white sex, the black-white bodies where you can tell that there's some kind of skin color difference and it was somehow aesthetically pleasing. They couldn't do that somehow, so it was inserted in this other way. And that was very interesting methodologically because, you know, you couldn't really tell where these films were from and if they were U.S. or they were Asian. Sometimes you could tell that they were Asian later on, but the earlier films, they were actually white women in yellow face. So they were putting on these garments and, you know, flowers in the hair. There was the gardenia giant flower, the buns like Princess Leia, you know, and then the kimono outfits and the fans and the shoji suit. There was a kind of a uniform of what an Asian woman is supposed to look like, right? So yeah, so that's the discovery in the stag films. And later on, you know, kind of post-World War II, yellow-faced white women performing Asian women became replaced by women who looked Asian, whatever that means. But they looked Asian to me. And it was interesting because, you know, the classification of the pornography really happened in the 1970s when the Kinsey got a grant to kind of just organize the films. And the woman who organized the films, Martha Harsanyi, who I ended up interviewing, said that she herself found that she alone had to determine that this woman was Asian or not. So it was also based on a kind of 1970s understanding of, you know, who an Asian woman was, rather than, you know, someone from the 1920s or 30s or 40s cataloging these images. So it was someone from the 70s deciding that these were Asian women. But somehow it was hard to tell, you know, even though the intertitle text was saying, you know, oh, this is an Asian woman. So what happened later on in the stag films from the 50s, where these real Asian women were performing, was that they were no longer a stranger coming in to audition the Asian woman for a circus dance show. They were the boyfriend of the woman or the husband of the woman. It was no longer an intruder coming in to have sex with a woman, but they were these kind of tender, intimate relationships that had prior knowledge. So one shot that I found very interesting was, rather than the insertion of Orientalist accoutrements, objects within the shot, all of a sudden there was a diamond ring in the middle of the genital shot. So there was a writing of Asian women as somehow legible, legitimate partners, domestic partners for these white men in interracial sex. So that was happening post 1940s. And the later films, the supposed golden age of pornography from the 1970s to the 80s, you know, like when they had budgets. It wasn't in video, but it was, you know, film and there were sets. Found a large number of representations of Asian women as spoils of war. You know, like, there she was in the bar, and it was that kind of narrative of, you know, we fell in love, but then after that she tried to kill me, you know. So that was also happening the same way that was happening in James Bond movies. But I found that even in those movies where they were playing like the Oriental maid or, you know, the Asian woman spoil of war or the Chinatown, you know, tour guide who after you have sex with her would like bring in all her friends and they would try to rob you, and or they were somehow protecting some kind of Oriental secret, you know, like objects that somehow would give pleasure to everybody. So everyone's trying to get this object, but then the Asians are protecting it from people, you know. So those kinds of narratives were going on. But even then, when they were real Asian women, they were still performing yellow face versions of what an Asian woman looked like. So even in the pornography from the 60s, 70s, 80s, they were there as Asians. They weren't there as just women, you know. An Asian reason, as Justin Lin calls it, an Asian reason for the presence of Asians on screen. So they were Asians as sexual objects in these films. And I study the first Asian American woman porn star, Linda Wong, as well as Mai Lin, Christara Barrington, you know, women who had made hundreds of porn films, which then led me to start thinking about, well, is Asian American female stardom possible in pornography, and who are these stars? So I started in another chapter after the stag films, I started studying two very famous, if not the most famous, Asian women porn stars from the 1990s, and they are Asia Carrera, the geek of porn, because she's a member of Mensa, got a full scholarship to Rutgers, like a kind of model minority girl. And, you know, why did I get all A's and ended up a porn star? You know, there's an essay like that in her website. And she also authored her own website. And I started thinking about, well, What is it about her stardom that's supposedly like a kind of success story because she's profiting from her own commodification? You know, she makes her own website, sells her own dolls, directed her own movies that are somehow, you know, biographical. You know, like, I'm a concert pianist and somehow my parents were so oppressive, so I ran away and then I discovered sexuality and now I'm getting paid for it. So it's a success story, right? But I found that to be, like, good for her, good for Asia Carrera. And but that led me to look at someone else who was the other super famous, infamous Asian woman porn star of the 90s, and that's Annabelle Chong. Annabelle Chong started out in the porn industry as an undergrad at USC in women's studies, and her agenda was to prove that women can be studs, not sluts, when they conquer men. And so she initiated this idea of the world's biggest gangbang. And so she had sex with, well, 251 times over 10 hours. And there was a documentary made about the experience called Sex, the Annabelle Chong Story, which premiered at Sundance, and that was a big deal at the time to see, you know, this porn at Sundance. And I felt that Annabelle Chong's life and her occupation of the role of the performer within pornography was a very powerful way of criticizing the racialization of gender through sexuality, that it's a messy, messy morass, you know, that it would be important not necessarily to have a very easy and clean success story when what needs to be documented are the struggles of trying to gain access to your representation, or for women to try to expand what is considered a powerful female sexuality. So what happens then for this racialized woman to claim a monstrous version of sexuality, and how can that be a feminist project? Especially when she wasn't getting paid for the work, right? And so it's really quite messy, but I felt that an argument that started emerging for me in looking at this woman was, what does it mean for us to dismiss women who are considered bad, women who are considered perverse, women who start practicing sexuality in ways that we don't necessarily approve of? What is the feminist critique that they're offering, and is it worth listening to, and is it worth defending? So this leads me back to that position on the bus when I was 17 of wanting to make separations of who are good women and who are bad women. What does it mean to have those kinds of classifications for women who are struggling in so many different fronts to correct these representations, to render their realities in a hopefully better way, that they're struggling for them? So when you read critically what Annabelle Chong is trying to do, she's really trying to make sense. I mean, in the simplest way, like, what does it mean for women to sleep around, right? To kind of celebrate their sexuality in the same way that men do all the time. You know, that the slut versus the stud, it's so simple a project, but it's been met with a lot of fear and a lot of panic, because Annabelle Chong's most famous image is the one of her face in the gangbang. Can you tell if she's in pain or she's in pleasure? And what does it mean to claim that we may not know whether she's in pain or she's in pleasure? And I found that this started to be a commentary for me on what it means to study representation and race, that it's important to be in a place where we are listening to what these women are saying between the spaces of structure and agency, slavery and freedom, that it's always somewhere in between. You know, so when we diagnose this problem and say these women have no agency, or women who, or other scholars who say it's all about the agency of these women, I would argue that we need to be very specific and find out the in-betweenness of it. You know, that there isn't necessarily one solution where it's all about sexual freedom and proving that they are not sexually dominated, or proving that they are completely dominated, right? Like, it's a very human experience, in the same way that watching a film is a very human experience, that you can love it and you can hate it, but somehow, hopefully, it will cause transformation or challenging of the self, right? And so that's what Annabelle Chong does for me, you know, is there's a kind of plea to listen to the situation and to take account of the messy ways we are racialized and sexualized, and what is the best response to it, And she went for it in terms of this particular response. So one of the results for me that was highlighted was the very easy way we can say Annabelle Chong is in pain, therefore it is a witnessing of her rape, or Annabelle Chong is in pleasure, therefore she's in control of her sexuality. But I think that it's so much more complicated than that. And I've come to realize that racialized women are too easily used as the kind of litmus test for talking about pornography as an ultimate victimization. It's people of color who are somehow victimized by sexuality, and I want to be very careful about that because I think that their victimization can do great damage in dehumanizing them if it doesn't allow for them to have desire or sexuality. One chapter that was probably the most difficult one for me to write, I think it took 5 years to write this chapter, and it's called Little Brown Fucking Machines Powered by Rice, Politicizing the Bottom in Southeast Asian Movies. It really came to a head for me in this chapter, you know, because the new pornography post-90s started looking crazy, you know, this gonzo pornography, professional amateur pornography, where it's very much like a cinema verite kind of pornography. And one of the most popular gonzo porn for Asian women is this series called 101 Asian Debutantes, which is made by an ethnically ambiguous white man called Jean-Marc Roch. And it's a series that was made in the 90s, and he's a sex tourist who goes to Southeast Asia, Korea, Thailand, and the Philippines, and has these relationships with these women. So some women, you know, he'll negotiate their sexual transaction. $10, two women, you know, you don't even know if there's a consent form, what's happening here. But some women he's had sex with for 10 years, you know, from 1992 to 2002, or whatever it is, 1988 to 1998. So there are these relationships that show up in the cinema verite gonzo pornography. And so what's going on in a situation like this, like a site of radical inequality, for to be able to look at these images, especially because these images weren't made for me. And I found that, you know, I actually felt really uncomfortable going to porn shops that weren't owned by Asians. Like, that doesn't make sense at all, but I went to Berkeley, I went to San Francisco to look at all the porn shops, and I always would navigate myself towards the ones that were run by Filipinos and would talk to them and somehow tell them, like, oh, you know, I'm just looking at these things to study them, you know, and I was in Daily City, I became a regular in this Daily City one, and I mean, how bizarre, like, once again, it was that kind of haunting of, I'm a good woman studying these things, you know, because I was always the only woman there in the secret room in the back, and I was always there, and so when I started looking at these films that weren't meant for me, and I'm not even supposed to be watching these films, because I was living in Palo Alto at Stanford at the time, and I would always turn down the sound in case my neighbors thought I was a freak, and I was always watching these things in the middle of the day, and I had a giant collection, so the cleaner, I was always telling her, this is mine, not my husband's, he's really nice, he's not like this weirdo guy who's like imposing his porn collection on me, they're mine, which made it even more weird for her, I think, you know. And so, anyway, it took a long time to write these movies, to write the chapter. Because I was very much wrestling with the gaze of the woman at the camera and even her participation in making the gonzo porn, where she would say, you know, she would be really irritated with the filmmaker for framing her in a certain way, so she'd be like shoving him and moving the camera and then checking herself out, and then she's like happy, and then she's like, okay, let's do it. And there were other times, of course, where, like, is it this power relationship that we're seeing when the woman is saying, let's use a condom? The guy's like, no, let's not use a condom. So it goes on for a while, and they end up not using a condom. And you can't tell if it's rehearsed or it's not rehearsed. And so when in looking at these images, and it was a really haunting experience for me because I didn't expect for this woman's kind of, you know, super focused gaze on the camera to... It was like a discombobulating experience for me. Like, it was like a piercing gaze. And, you know, I could see that for maybe other audiences, that's the point of this porn, right? Like, you're supposed to enjoy her squalor, enjoy her poverty, enjoy her lack of choices that she has to be in this video. But it also spoke to me in a different way because I was seeing that she was somehow participating in what was going on in the authorship of these texts. So for me, the question of authorship, the question of spectatorship, the question of power in the production of these images, and even enjoyment in sexuality. Like, what does an orgasm look like for these women? And what does it mean to acknowledge that it's possible for women in sex work to have an orgasm, right? And to see it on screen. And once again, you know, you can't tell what's going on, what's true, what's not true. But it's important to ask the question. So I found this set of films to be very important in terms of documenting power relationships. And what does it mean for us to see a sex act? Why is it unacceptable for us to see sex acts in movies, right? Like, it's so celebrated now. Tell Me You Love Me, the new series on HBO, is it? Right? Like, it's a big deal. Like, sex is a site where you can figure out people's relationships, so we're going to show it, right? So it started making me question, what is an acceptable form of consuming sexuality and representing sexuality, right? Why is it located in either porn or not porn, where it's like kissing is the substitute for penetration, right? Anyway, I was then led to return to Dennis O'Rourke's Good Woman of Bangkok, 1991, very famous film. And this is what I wrote my undergraduate thesis on. And I found that that movie, once again, was a kind of very clean movie in the sense that, you know, Dennis O'Rourke, an award-winning kind of liberal guy, you know, critique of colonialism and tourism. He won a big award from Australia, $100,000, do whatever you want. So he said, I'm going to make a film that would otherwise never be funded. So I'm going to have sex with a prostitute, have a relationship with her, I'm going to document that. I'm going to start the movie by unrolling a condom. That's the first thing you'll see, which he never does, because, of course, it's an unacceptable way of looking at sexuality in a movie, right? So anyway, in this movie, I thought that what was interesting about it was, you know, the interviews that went hand in hand with the movie, because a lot of people were really mad about this movie, feminist, post-colonial critics, but then they said, after I watched it, I realized this is the only film possible to be made that actually humanizes a Southeast Asian woman. We would otherwise never hear of her, you know? So that was like, it was celebrated afterwards. And he supposedly was destroying the idea of the filmmaker as hero, because he was going to start doing this, and then he was going to redeem himself somehow. And the whole story is that he gave her a rice farm. Then he actually ended up giving her two rice farms when you do more reading. But what I found through The Good Woman of Bangkok was somehow the persistence of the white male filmmaker as a hero after all, you know, at her expense. And I found that what was happening in the gonzo pornography, in its messiness, we were able to look at the power relationships and we were able to see how Asian women themselves were trying to engage the camera, to usurp the camera, to try to say something. But you couldn't really tell with The Good Woman of Bangkok, where he would say in the interviews that they were collaborators and that they were in love, and who can comment on what goes on inside a love relationship? She had power. She loved me less than I loved her. Right, so you can kind of see that these same power relationships are kind of remaining the same, and that the film comes to be used, I think, in ways that actually disenfranchise her, even though it's one of the films where she's just talking so much to the camera, and, you know, her presence somehow authorizes his discussion with other prostitutes, where you can kind of see and hear for the first time these discussions like, oh, Japanese tip, Koreans don't tip, Chinese don't tip. You know, there's this kind of distinction of like masculinities and what these men are getting out of these relationships. So there's a kind of celebration of the filmmaker for giving us this information. But then what happens to her? I don't know. What happens to these other women? So I wanted to blow up these questions of what we can know, what kind of speaking is possible for these women through bodily speech, through the attempts to usurp the camera. So I conclude the book by looking at the work of Asian American women feminist filmmakers who themselves are trafficking in explicit sexuality. I think they themselves are making commentary on why is it that porn is where sex is and there's more safe sex in our everyday watching of Hollywood movies, etc. But I think that they're trying to do something else. They're trying to expand their idea of who Asian women are and what realities and representations can happen for them, whether they're trying to be normal women, good women, or bad women. Thank you very much. Yeah.
My name is Devin Dagwell. I'm actually a second-year film major. I'm very happy to be here. But I'm actually going to propose this to the whole panel. What are your views on the role of narrative brevity when it comes to pornography as a contributing factor, or in fact, dissuading factor in social or in racial undertones when it comes to pornography? I mean, inherently, the Stag films were shorts, and at the end of the day, pornography is all about eroticism. But the example is also brought up that in the 1950s, there was a hint of backstory towards some of the intimate scenarios. And actually, this last summer, I went with a friend to Hate Street in San Francisco and viewed what I believe was translated to The Glorious Life of Sachiko Hanai, a film from Japan of the pink film genre. And I believe it had gained notoriety in Western independent film circuits, and that's why it was being shown there. But what was interesting about that film was, in I guess stereotypical pink film genre fashion, there was intimacy every 10 minutes. But what was more interesting was that it had established a narrative that was self-satirical, almost self-ridiculing, such that when my friend and I exited the theater, we weren't left with the feeling that we had just gone and watched saturated pornography for an hour and a half, 2 hours, what have you, but actually seen something very clever and unique. So what's your opinion on, I guess, the narrative role in pornography?
I know why you're looking at me. Not just the film professor, but also... one of the, I'm writing a book called Teaching Pornography, and what it is, it's really just a litany of surprises, of what I and my students discovered about pornography, when you look at it from the beginning, through every period, every style, when you look at style, strategies, audiences, venues, modes of production, legal issues, star system. In other words, everything that you would study if you were studying Hollywood film or even independent filmmaking. And some of the very first surprises that we get is the amount of humor there is in pornography. And certainly that's the case with the short Stag films, one or two reels, because they were based on, it's like part and parcel of the folklore of American smut, And so you have Stag films that were, farmer's daughter's jokes, traveling salesman jokes, Aggie jokes. And so, and one of the reasons why that humor was probably important to that, I mean, it was the humor of the dirty joke. These films were watched in men's venues, and they were silent, and so the soundtrack, if you will, is just what the men at the fraternal lodge, the fraternity house, or the Lions Club, as my father confessed to me shortly before his death. And so the humor was important for, so as everybody's talking back to the screen, talking to each other, and the humor was kind of important for that kind of a homosocial bonding that was going on there. It gives you a little bit of distance. But also, as we end up tracking the way humor gets used right on up to today, there is one of the other surprises that we got was how often the butt of the joke was the man, and often at the hands of a trickster women, who are showing the man up, for all of his sexual and social ignorance. Darn, I wish I had some of those films right here. And so, so there's, you know, one of the things that I've argued and that I and my students discovered was that, you know, these films are made, you know, for men by other men, you know, and so shouldn't, you know, why would there be these films full of humor, you know, where the man is often the butt of the joke? And, you know, one of the things that we've talked about and think may possibly be the reason is because these films, as popular culture, and as we know that popular culture doesn't have its popular appeal because of just, you know, it gives pleasure, but also because for popular culture to be popular, it also has to speak to people's ideas and anxieties, you know. And so why shouldn't these stag films made for men by other men also address not just their pleasures, you know, but their anxieties, you know, as well? So anyway, and that's and done through humor, you know, where the man is the butt of the joke. Then there's whole other reasons why, you know, you have humor in porn. I mean, a lot of the humor in porn today is in the Hollywood film and television send-ups of porn. You know, most recently, the porn comedy Pirates, you know, the first probably million-dollar porn film. But anyway, just the way that, you know, porn uses humor to send up a lot of the hypocrisies and pretensions of Hollywood. But I'm not, did that answer your question about why brevity, the role of brevity?
Well, I was just wondering if, in theory, if given enough narrative explanation in pornography, that some of these, or I guess most of these situations, could in fact debunk racial stereotypes. If in the example from the 1950s, if the, I believe, like white male and Asian wife, if their relationship had been depicted as a very long-standing one and their sex life a very mutually satisfactory endeavor, if that would change the impression that the viewer gets when seeing the imagery on the screen of the woman, you know, with a pained face or whatnot during the actions, if that would, I guess, clarify the mysticism around the racial undertones.
I think it would be a different object because the narrative brevity is necessary for the purpose of the porn, which is, you know, to masturbate to it, right? Like, it has to be kind of narratively brief. The longer it is, then that it wouldn't be the thing that it is, I think, right? And the representations in the 50s of the interracial white male, Asian female sex is that of pornotopia, you know? And I think that was very interesting at the time against the context of the racial treat, not the racial threat, but I'm not sure racial pornotopia in a longer narrative would be interesting to watch now. I think that maybe if the power relationship is taken out of the encounter, it could be less interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also a lot of pressure to keep it brief by companies, even when people who are directors and producers want to make it, you know, something more, something closer to Hollywood, where you have these kind of narratives teased out. I was just reading a review for Desperate Black Wives, which is, you know, a total send up on Desperate Housewives. And, you know, it's directed by a black woman who had been a performer for a long time. And the first 15, they complain in the review that it's only 15 minutes into the film that you have the first sex scene. They're like, this is just just untenable. Like, what kind of porn film is this? We need it, you know, now, and we want it to be over with, and we want to have these distinct kind of scenes that are as long as it takes to jack off, really. So the kind of development of a lot of narrative, there are these kind of like institutional constraints or expectations by spectators too that shape these things. But I think it's interesting too to think about the kind of technological influences on creating these kind of styles that porn, if anything, definitely replicates and repeats again and again, like stereotype, what they find is successful and what works. And so we see that there's sometimes a problem in actually changing that. But the moments that it does, when you have these theatrical releases in the 70s during the golden age, were really, you know, groundbreaking. And one of the reasons that they don't last is because, again, the technology and the mode of reception has to change. The porn theaters close, and everyone starts getting VHSs at home. So it becomes, again, these kind of private masturbatory projects that, again, narrative brevity works. There's someone back there, too.
I'm Sarah. I think that all of us here, and what you've all been talking about, especially Celine, with you talking about allowing these women to negotiate their own image, requires us to be very conscious consumers of their image, and they're like, you know, allowing multiple interpretations of like how they are, like what they're doing, how that comes across to audiences. So I guess my question is, what do you think is going on between audiences and the image that perhaps aren't as conscious as we are all being right now? Do you think there is still a space for the women to have agency and negotiate what they are putting across to an audience if the audience isn't being a conscious consumer of that image? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I think this question is important because it gets to the heart of what our enterprise is in the academy, you know, which is how can we teach students as part of their citizenship to become good visual readers, or good readers of moving images, especially because there's a lack of education on how to dissect a film, right? So, I mean, I think that is a shared enterprise and one that we keep in mind every day that we're in the classroom or every day that we interact with students. But I do think that already the outside the academy that people are sophisticated about what they want to see in their films, you know. So even if it's Lucy Liu or Sandra Oh, you know, these actors generate very interesting discussion outside of the academy, and you can see it, you know, in the many blogs that are out there, or even when people are buying stuff on Amazon, right? I mean, the kind of critical commentary that's out there in the world, you know. So I think that we have to recognize that it's important not to generalize a mass that's out there that's illiterate, you know, and that people have very creative relationships with these movies outside of this space.